Let's call this meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1:04 p.m. on Friday, June 4th, 2021. Before we begin, I want to thank Sophia Tenney, the House Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Nate Williams and Vanessa Head from the Juneau and Anchorage LIOs, who make sure we have sound at this time. I want to remind committee members and those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, it looks like we have, I think it's Representative Eastman. I'm just trying to look at initials on Teams. Representative Eastman and Representative, hang on. Looks like we have Representative Eastman on Teams, Representative Christ Tompkins on the telephone, Representative Drummond on the telephone, Representative Eastman on the telephone, and Representative Vance on the telephone. And Representative Snyder is here in the LIO with me, and we have a quorum to conduct business. Our first and only order of business today is House Joint Resolution 7, Constitutional Amendment, Permanent Fund and Permanent Fund Dividends, sponsored by the House Rules Committee by request of the Governor. This is the fourth hearing of the joint resolution in the House Judiciary Committee. Today we will continue to hear invited testimony. First, we're going to hear from Angela Rodell on the rules regarding spending limits and of the permanent fund as put forward by the Board of Trustees. Second, we'll hear from Curtis Thayer on the proposal to put the Power Cost Equalization Fund into the permanent fund corpus. And finally, we'll hear from former Senator Rick Halford about permanent fund history as well as dividend history. And with us today, and she is here by Teams, is Angela Rodell, Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. Ms. Rodell, if you want to put yourself on the record, and you can begin your remarks. I know we also have some slides that you provided, so we'll probably see the slides and not you, but please proceed.
Well, Coleman, you can't hear anything on the press conference.
Just a minute. If somebody's on the line that is not muted, please mute your line. Ms. Rodell, if you want to continue, I think we've solved whatever the problem is.
So as I was saying, in the late 1990s, the generally accepted accounting principles changed to include fair market value concepts into the definition of income, which meant that you had to include the concept of unrealized gains and losses. And as we know, this is not actual cash, and so it created an interesting conundrum for the permanent fund and how the permanent fund was accounted for. And it led to the system we have today, which is a two-account structure. So if you go to the first slide, and many of you are probably familiar with this idea of the two-account structure, we have principal and we have the earnings reserve account. And the principal is the constitutionally established as the principal as the permanent part of the fund. It's what we all talk about as the permanent fund. It grows through royalty contributions any special appropriations and appropriations for inflation proofing. So I think what's really important to note here is that it cannot grow through changes, or shrink, I should say, through changes in market value. And it is to only be used for income-producing investments. This is the language that is in the Constitution, refers to income-producing investments. The earnings reserve account was established then to collect all of the net income from the portfolio. It grows through the receipt of what we have in Alaska as statutory net income, monthly cash flows from investments, net income from asset sales. It could be, when I say cash inflows from investments, this could be rentals from our real estate. This could be dividends from bond payments, anything that creates cash that flows then into the earnings reserve account directly. And this is the account that is available for legislative appropriation. So if you go to the next slide, our principal of the fund has really grown as a result of all of the appropriation activities that have taken place around it. The first, we have received from inception to date $17.8 billion in royalty deposits. This includes the constitutional minimum required of 25% of proceeds, along with statutorily mandated deposits of 50% that have been appropriated for leases after 1979. We have also received $18 billion in inflation-proofing appropriations, and this is a calculation that is based on annual inflation on the balance of the principal of the fund only, so it's not the entirety of both accounts, rather just the principal of the fund. And what this does is it allows the principal of the fund to take advantage of inflation, because otherwise we would only have that $17.8 billion, and it would not be adjusted for inflation. It wouldn't be allowed to keep any of its growth that has happened as a result of that. And then in addition, there have been $11 billion in special appropriations over the years. This includes $2.7 billion directly from the general fund, as well as $8.3 billion from the earnings reserve account. $4 billion of that $8.3 billion was the appropriation that came through in fiscal year 2020. So when we look at the earnings reserve account on the next slide, you can see how statutory net income, which is how the earnings reserve account grows, moves very different than total return. And total return reflects the volatility in the market, and you'll see that in the bold line, how it moves around, whereas the statutory net income, for the most part, has a steady increase and then a drop and then withdrawals, and then it increases again, withdrawals, steady increases. So it's very different than investment and market activity that drives the market value of the fund, because this is really based on those monthly cash inflows, stock dividends, bond interest in real estate, as well as realizing those capital gains and losses. And what we're seeing in FY21 is that through April 30th, our statutory net income is almost $6 billion, which will be almost on pace to meet the same as 2018. In 2018, it was due to a specific asset sale that generated a huge gain. In 2021, it is due to a deliberate rebalancing effort to stay within our asset allocation and manage our risk appropriately. One of the questions that I was asked to cover was about the investment management of those different funds. And what we do, we could go to the next slide, is that our fund is managed as if it were one total fund. So we don't have a different investment management strategy for the earnings reserve account versus the principal of the fund. within the Constitution and within statutes, we have specific mandates, principles to provide permanent savings, the earnings reserve account to hold investment income for appropriation, and we are to act under investor rule to govern our savings, our spending, and our growth. We have a long-term horizon. So when we look at our investment allocation, we are looking at it from a 10-plus year viewpoint. We are not looking at our asset allocation from a day-to-day, month-to-month, or within year, quarter-to-quarter viewpoint. It also requires APFC to be accountable as to how we manage this money and to make sure that we have the resources to do it effectively. So when we look at our asset allocation, you're really going to see on the next slide how this has changed over the years. And in 1980, we were 100% in bonds. If you think back to the 1980s, end of the 70s, 1980s, you saw overnight rates in the 15 to 20% range. Income was easily generated as a result of just being invested in bonds. In 1983, we were allowed to invest in U.S. real estate and U.S. stocks. And then over the course of the years, that expanded into international markets. In 2005, statutes were passed to allow us to take more risk and to invest in private equity, absolute return, private income. And that takes us to where we are today. You'll see our 2021 target allocation, 39% in stocks, 22% in bonds. This, the entirety of all the assets that we manage, whether it's mental health trust, earnings reserve account, or permanent fund principal, are all invested in this asset allocation. Each pool of money owns a pro rata share of each investment. So every stock that we own is owned a little bit by the principal, a little bit by the ERA, and a little bit by Mental Health Trust Authority. Mm-hmm. Every month, we do the reconciliations to be able to release the balances in each of those accounts so everyone knows where those accounts stand. And it takes us roughly three weeks, almost 4 weeks to do the reconciliation because we have over 700 accounts with multiple investments in all those accounts. So rather than setting up three asset allocations and managing it that way, this was the route that was set up and has been set up since we started having the two account structure. The constitutional amendment that you are contemplating would move us from that two account structure of principal and earnings to a single account structure. And this has been a priority of the trustees since 2000. And as I said, it was in the late 90s that the accounting rules changed. And it was at that time that we realized that it was really important for the fund to be able to hold on to some of its gains. It would mean we no longer needed appropriations for inflation, that the fund would be able to grow on its own. It would naturally limit spending as a result of a percent of market value structure. Since then, in 2003 and 2004, trustees adopted resolutions supporting a constitutional amendment to limit the fund payout to not more than 5%. Averaged over a period of 5 years, and that implementation of a constitutional spending limit for the fund has the benefit of ensuring permanent inflation proofing for the fund. On slide 8, we put together a graphic to show how money moves through. So you see the contributions coming in on the left. They're being invested. Everything stays with the principal until things are realized, cash is received, and that puts into the earnings reserve account. Appropriations then move out of the earnings reserve account to pay for corporate operations, investment expenses, inflation proofing, and the percent of market value. The proposed structure, as you'll see on the next slide, is much simpler. All of the funds come in. They're constitutionally protected. I think it's important to note that they continue to be constitutionally protected. They continue to be invested in income-producing investments. Gains and losses stay with the fund. And all that moves out now is the percent of market value and corporate expenses, those investment management fees. And so it's a much simpler, straightforward management endowment structure of the fund. I want to pause there, Mr. Chairman, and see if there are any questions at this point.
Questions from members of the committee, and because we got, I can't see anybody in the Teams screen. If you have questions, just please speak up and I'll recognize you.
Mr. Chair, this is Representative Chris Tompkins, if I can ask a question.
Please proceed. And I'd also note that Representative Kirk also has also joined us. Please proceed.
Okay, thank you. And I apologize. I'm in Angoon, and the cell connection is a little tenuous, but I think I heard the go-ahead. And if I'm coming through okay, my question is maybe just a little afield of the thrust of the legislation in committee, but Mr. Riddell, you mentioned that there's a little bit of pro-rata ownership by the Alaska Mental Health Trust and their assets under management. And I guess I asked this just in the spirit of sort of looking more about Permanent Fund Corporation and how it manages state assets. And I think there was an amendment in the operating budget on the House side, which I don't know if it's staying in or not in conference committee, about other state assets in addition to the permanent fund and in addition, I suppose, to the mental health trust that also could be managed for return by the Permanent Fund Corporation. I was just wondering sort of what the corporation's perspective is on that, what the pros and cons of sort of putting additional state accounts or public assets under management, a la the Mental Health Trust, under corporation management.
Ms. Riddell?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a little bit trouble hearing because there's a big echo in the room for me with his question, but I think I understood the question to be, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, as to if we take additional assets of the state under management, how would that work with one asset allocation? Is that correct?
I think that's correct, and I think the second part of the question is, what does the corporation have a position on the advisability of doing that to the extent we chose to?
So in terms of taking additional assets of the state into management, we are prepared to do that should it be necessary. Depending on what those assets are, we can put them into our asset allocation. When the Mental Health Trust Authority monies came over to us, that was part of the direction that was given to us at that time. If the monies that come over have different requirements for their usage. So, for example, the Constitutional Budget Reserve, to take for example, has duration limits in its statute. We would not obviously be able to incorporate that into the asset allocation because of those limitations that are put in statute. So we can make it work. It will take resources to make it work, just to be clear. Part of why we do what we do right now is to limit, is not to limit, but because of the limitations in terms of our body count and resource count and our ability to have multiple financial statements and all of that. So I don't know what the fiscal note would look like on something like that, but it's something that we can and have done in the past.
Representative Christ Tompkins, any follow-up?
No. Thank you. That's very helpful.
Thank you. Representative Eastman, I understand you raised your hand. Please proceed with your question.
Thank you. My question supports up with the costs that are withdrawn from the fund by the corporation. And just when, what is the timeline on those costs and as well as the timeline on the percent of market value withdrawal? When did those withdrawals take place? And can you just tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So, through the chair, Representative Eastman, the APFC operating and investment management, the monies are taken in accordance with the budget documents that are adopted. So that serves as our cap or limitation, and we take them throughout the fiscal year as needed. So, for example, for personal services, for the fund, for the corporation, those are taken out on every couple of weeks when we have to make payroll. We take the required distribution out of the earnings reserve account for that purpose. In terms of the percent of market value withdrawal, those monies are taken out in accordance with a memorandum of understanding with Treasury Division under the Department of Revenue. So since the TOMB statutes were adopted in 2018, each year we've worked with Treasury. They lay out what their expected cash needs are, and we set up those withdrawals. They have the ability to change those withdrawals. They try to give us about a week's notice on that, and generally the way they've skewed is if revenue comes in faster or higher from other sources than they expected, then they delay withdrawing their POMB and push it to the last withdrawal by the end of the fiscal year. So, for example, for FY21, we have one final distribution to make. It's about $480 million, and we'll make that now here at the end of June, and that'll be the final payment for the FY21 POMB.
Thank you.
Follow-up?
No.
Thank you. Any other questions from members of the committee? I have a couple of questions. First, in terms of the unrealized gains, when we calculate the total value of the fund and the earnings reserve, are the unrealized gains included in that calculation?
Yes, they are, Mr. Chair. So if you go to the next slide, this will
it shows you
the number. It doesn't show you the years of the calculation, but it is based on the market value, and market value includes unrealized gains, or it would include unrealized losses to the extent there were unrealized losses. So it is that net market value. You take the 5 years, you average it, and that's what gets included in the calculation.
You talked about how there was a change in the definition of earnings in the late 90s. Did that impact how the fund looked at unrealized and realized gains for purposes of earnings versus principal?
It required the legislature to come up with the definition of statutory net income so that we could know what was income under the Constitution and what would be moved into the earnings reserve account. And there have been times where all of the gains and losses were recognized in the earnings reserve account. There was a time when they were all recognized in the principal of the account, and now for the last few years, they've been pro rata shared between the two accounts until they're realized. And that has has to do with different interpretations that we've received over the years from the Department of Law. And I think part of the challenge with this is that we became a lot more sophisticated in how we were investing. And so, for example, 40% of the fund now is our private market investment. So it's real estate, it's private equity, it's private income. They have very delayed. They do quarterly statements. They're usually lagged for a significant period of time. And you just see the changes in value up or down. And so we invest very differently than what was contemplated when the original constitutional amendment was passed. I think that's why PONB structure is so attractive and so helpful to the permanent fund, because it recognizes all the different asset classes that we are now able to invest in, take advantage of, benefit from, and not get caught in sort of 1970 definitions of income.
Did we name the income account the earnings reserve account from the very beginning, or was there a later point in time when we named it the earnings reserve account?
Mr. Chairman, I actually don't know where the naming nomenclature came. It's been the earnings reserve account as long as I've been aware of. And that's what I've seen in statute. So I'm not sure what the history of that is.
A couple more questions, and then you can go forward. In terms of the $18 billion in inflation proofing pursuant to AS 3713-145C, have we made that deposit every year to your knowledge, or have there been years we've made less?
Mr. Chairman, there are 3 years in particular. So in 2010, inflation was zero, so there was no inflation proofing deposit. And then there was no inflation proofing appropriations in 17, 18, and 19. In FY20, the $4 billion moved from principal to from earnings reserve account to principal, had legislative intent language that said it was forward funding inflation proofing. There's no inflation proofing in the FY21 budget. There's no inflation proofing in either version of the operating budget for FY22 that is now in conference committee.
But in 17, 18, and 19, there was inflation, and in those years, we did not make the deposit that's set out in AS 3713-145C.
That is correct.
Okay. I think that's actually a couple more questions, and then you can keep rolling on. On that, am I correct that the principal, where it's providing permanent savings, those are invested for the long term, where the ERA, because it needs to be available for appropriation, those are more liquid appropriations and may not realize the same gains that the principal is making?
That is incorrect.
Okay.
This goes back to my earlier statement about how the asset allocation, every single asset is owned on a pro rata share, so proportionally by the principal and the earnings reserve account and the mental health trust fund. So a dollar of for a share of Apple stock might be owned 50 cents by the principal, 20 cents by the earnings reserve account, and 30 cents by the mental health trust, if that were the proportions. It's not. Those aren't the proportions, by the way, but that's the example I'm trying to give. So the earnings reserve account has a very long time horizon on its asset allocation, and that is because that's the direction we were given in statute, and none of that has changed.
And so does that effectively mean if you need cash to, say, transfer to state operations, then you just sell something that is easily liquidated, or do you actually sell some of the stock and some of the bonds and everything else? I mean, do you sell consistent with the asset allocation, or do you sell the things that are more liquid?
So this is why it's so important to have the rule of the POMB, because then we have the surety of knowing what the cash calls by the state are going to be, and we can plan around that. So we get regular cash income, and if we know, for example, we're going to make a $480 million payment at the end of June, as we're receiving cash this month, we'll hold on to it rather than investing it in the asset allocation in order to make that payment, so that we don't have to sell something at a gain or a loss in order to make those payments. But 60% of the fund is invested in highly liquid assets, in stocks and bonds, that could be liquidated within 3 days.
And then the last questions I had on slide number 6, when you talked about changing the asset allocation, it sounds like the permanent fund made some changes before there was a statutory change. What's the dynamic between the funds? How does the fund have authority to change asset allocation, and what was the need for legislative action with a statute rather than however else the fund has authority to change its allocation?
So in the enabling statutes of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, the legislature put in a specific allowed list of investments. So if you go back and look at the statutes creating the fund and you looked at the 1980 version, you would see that we were only allowed to invest the fund in bonds. Over the years, that statutory list was amended to add various assets like U.S. stocks or U.S. real estate. And then in 2005, the statute was completely revised, and all of the allowable lists of investments was repealed, and in its place was put the prudent investor rule. In other words, we could invest in anything a prudent investor of similar size, similar scope would invest in, and it required us to adopt regulations outlining what the investment types were that we could invest in. So you'll now see that we have regulations outlining and defining our investments, and that we follow the prudent investor rule. And that has then led to the change in asset classes that you see in FY21.
So just so I'm following you, in the 1980, you were all bonds. Then that changed over the years when the legislature would change the statute and give you authority to invest in other types of investments. And that gradually grew in length. And finally, in 2005, you went to the prudent investor rule that gave the corporation's board the authority to essentially establish regulations that set out how it made its investments.
Correct.
And I assume you haven't been back to the legislature to change that authority since 2005.
That's correct.
Okay.
We don't need any additional authority.
Okay. Those are all the questions I had. Thank you. If you want to proceed with the remainder of the slides, I knew that we're probably going to let you run a little longer than originally planned, but go ahead.
I just have a couple more, just to stop for a moment on that percent of market value, just to see how it's changed. FY22 is the first year that you have to step down from 5.25% to the 5% of that entitled $3.07 billion. We had calculated that earlier to be an effective rate of about 4.55%. It'll probably go down even further if we're able to end the fiscal year at the values we're seeing today. FY23 and 24 are also based on sort of those estimates. But you can see that what the percent of market value does is that even as the fund grows or has flat growth, 21 to 22, you see that 3.07, it doesn't create wild swings in revenues for the state. So you'll see steady growth or smaller declines, but you won't see sort of the hit that the state is used to seeing in revenue from wild oil price and production misses. If we go to the next slide, you'll see where we are, and this is to give you a picture of just how much the fund has changed and not changed from fiscal year 2016 to fiscal year 2021, so in the last 5 years. And what I really wanted to highlight here is In the principal on the left, you'll see that there was $39.4 billion in contributions in 2016. In 2021, there's $46.9 billion. If you take out the $4 billion of the special appropriation for FY20, you'll see that this would only be $42.9 billion. So the principal is really unable to grow without the support of those special appropriations. And I just put this in here to highlight because we know how much the fund has grown, and yet here you can see how the principal really doesn't benefit from any market growth at all. It just does not. And all of the unrealized gains you see in the principal, the minute those are realized, they move into the earnings reserve account. They do not stay behind in the principal of the fund. The earnings reserve account had $8.6 billion in 2016. We're now at $18.3 billion. What you don't see here is the over $11 billion that has been appropriated in that five-year period between 2016 and 2021. In terms of performance, we can jump to slide 13. I just want to touch on performance briefly. Every year in January, Callan, the board's general consultant, updates its capital market projections. These are not done just for the permanent fund. These are the projections given to all of their clients. And what you will see here is that the 10-year projection from last year, the total fund was expected to generate 6.75%, and that is going to go down to 6.2%. So the forecast by everyone that we hear from is that we're going to enter into a 10-year period of much slower, lower growth. So while we may not see it this year, and we may not see it in the next year or even the next couple of years, over the 10-year period, we are expected to enter this slow growth. A couple other things to highlight on the slide is you'll see that the bulk of the earnings are going to come from private equity, that 8% return, and public equity, 6.85%. Equity is growth. Equity is also the highest risk assets in the portfolio. So in order to run a diversified portfolio that has a balance of risk, we do need to be in things like absolute return and fixed income. Fixed income at 2.2%, bonds are not going to generate a lot of income and return for us over the next 10 years. If we go to the next slide, we'll see that fiscal year to date, we are at 25% for the fund, and we were at 2% for the fiscal year last year. So a big difference in performance in a very short period of time. We are beating all of our benchmarks for the most part. That fiscal year 21 to date of 25.02 is just under our passive index of 25.8. Hopefully we'll be able to pull that out and beat that again by the end of the fiscal year. Here you can also see that the board's long-term objective is to generate 5% real return plus inflation. And so we did not make that last year at 2% versus 5.65%, which you can see in the 37-year inception to date. We have managed to beat that, earning 9% versus 7.62%. So moving off of performance,
Actually, but before you go to the next slide, I think Representative Snyder may have a question about performance. Want to go ahead, Representative Snyder?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hi, Ms. Rodell. About performance, could you also speak briefly to how the performance of our fund here in Alaska might compare, does compare to similar types of funds elsewhere? Are there some other comparable funds that we can set side by side and get a sense of how well ours is doing compared to others, if there are any lessons to be learned, and how our performance benchmarks and objectives match up with those?
Through the chair, Representative Snyder, we will have to get back to you on that. These are the indices that the Board of Trustees have sent to measure our, has set that we are to be measured against. And Palin pairs this review for us. They do also do reviews for the board that include other funds around the country, like that include other endowments and foundations, other pension funds. So we do have some information that we can get back to you on that.
Thank you.
Representative Eastman, question.
Thank you. So I wanted to touch a little bit more on the percent of market value and the 5% level. Now, I had heard another presentation that 5% was too high, 4.25% would be better, more sustainable. So I'm wondering, though, if it ends up that 5% is what we do and it is too high, it's not sustainable, and portions of the corpus are being eroded, inadequate inflation sort of thing or inadequate market returns or what have you. I know you sent us a letter recently dealing with the royalty issue and the legislature not meeting their statutory obligation when it comes to royalty. Do you also have another letter you'll be sending us dealing with inflation proofing or the extent to which this 5% might be eroding the corpus?
Through the chairman, Representative Eastman, the 5% for a constitutional amendment, so we have to get rid of the concept of we no longer have a corpus, we no longer have a need for inflation proofing, because these are concepts that are in place because of the two-account structure and the requirement for an appropriation to put any money back into the principal. And the only way that the principal can grow today is through that action of the legislature. Under the endowment structure contemplated by HJR 7, there's no need for any of that because now the whole fund benefits from all the activity. It doesn't get allocated and appropriated out of two different accounts. And so I think
Ms. Rodell?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, it seemed like you... We lost you there for a second.
Okay, sorry about that.
It's okay.
I was just saying that the that what's so important about the endowment structure in HJR 7 is that it eliminates all the need to have the concept of corpus, the concept of inflation proofing, and the fund will benefit in its entirety from all the investment activity. And we won't need legislative action to allow one of the accounts to benefit like the other account. And so I just want to highlight that under HJR 7, all those concepts go away. It's only when you maintain the two-account structure that we are going to continue to need inflation proofing, that you're going to have to continue to keep an eye on the withdrawals out of the earnings reserve account. If, as for the inflation proofing, I think it's important to note we respect the legislative intent language. There's concerns that inflation will get away from us with the lack of appropriations on inflation proofing for the fund because the fund is growing so large and that inflation proofing needs to continue to happen to the extent we have a two-account structure.
Yeah, Representative Eastman.
So I guess that leads me to two questions. The first is, as we look to make this change with the constitutional amendment, do you have a number readily available as far as what the legislature should do under the current system to top off our inflation proofing obligations? Is there an amount based on our failure to do so in the past that you could communicate to us so that we know kind of where we're at right now before we make this change?
The chair, Representative Eastman, we do have the number. I don't have it in front of me, but we can get that to the committee as to what the past appropriations should have been and also what it would be this year for the FY22. So we can definitely get that number over to the committee, to you and the committee members.
Thank you. Paul?
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Chair. So I'm also wanting to know, should we expect that if our expectations end up being too rosy and our 5% that we're setting on now, if this amendment passes, ends up being a little high, that the corporation will come back to us and argue for a lower threshold? Or what should we expect if that turns out to be the case?
Through the chair, Representative Easton, I think that the 5% is a number that the trustees have supported for 20 years now. It is a number that is supported by the data in the performance on slide 14. So if you look at 10 years, 37 years, you'll see that we were able to keep up with a 5% expectation. And there will be times where it will look tough, and then there will be times where, like this year, where it would look really small relative to the overall performance of the fund. But the idea is that over time, that smooths out and creates stability for the fund. So I don't know what a future permanent fund board would say, but we have supported the 5% for 20 years now.
Thank you. Paula?
Yes, go ahead, Representative Eastman. We do have two more folks today, but please continue.
Great. All right, just one more question for now. You had previously mentioned the asset allocation. I was wondering, does the asset allocation currently include futures contracts or derivatives? If so, what are they classified as?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, we do have derivatives and future contracts. They usually happen within our fixed income portfolio. For example, we will hedge foreign currency exposure, and it will do that through those futures contracts. So that's usually where you will find the exposure. And you can find all the exposures listed in a disclosure in our annual report in the financial statement, in the notes to the financial statements in our annual report.
Thank you very much.
I don't see any other questions. If you want to continue, try to be quickly with the evolving role, and then we can get to the next presenter.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'll just touch very lightly on this. As you know, and as we've been talking now for a number of years, the role of the fund has changed. The trustees issued a paper in 2020, Volume 9, that talked about a number of reforms that would strengthen the stability. A part of that is having a formal POMB spending rule. And we talked about Lesson 5, reforming the ERA, and that really is rolling it into the fund and making it one fund with one account rather than the two-account structure. This paper is available on our website if anyone is interested in taking a look at it. And then finally, I think something that we keep talking about, the permanent fund being the revenue generator, and I think this is just really a very different mindset culturally for all of us. We're not used to thinking of the permanent fund as our source of, our primary source of revenue, and it's a renewable source of revenue. It does require effective management and investment of the fund, though, in order to be sustainable and for us to be able to really rely on it. And so our job at APFC as good stewards is to protect principal of the fund for the benefit of not just the current generation, but future generations of Alaskans, and to make sure that we can continue to provide that predictable stream, to make sure that the state continues to stay great state that we love it to be. And so with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to answer any further questions you might have.
I'm going to go ahead and Representative Price Tompkins has, so he has one last question. I'm going to go ahead and give him the last question just because we're a little behind schedule and I want to get to the next presenter. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A quick question is a couple slides back. Mr. Dell, you're commenting on the, I think it was the real return of the permanent fund over the last, I don't know how many decades it was. But I was wondering if you could restate that figure, what the actual, like the historic real return of the fund has been and how that, relates to, I think it's Callan's, sort of projected, like what's a reasonable assumption for projected, return, whether real or nominal, and just, juxtaposing those figures and commenting on them if possible.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, I was not able to hear. There was a lot of paper.
Mm.
I wasn't able to really hear the question. Something about Callan.
Well, I think the question more had to do with, it was partly Callan, but he wanted to know about, actually, Representative Christ Tompkins, why don't you ask the question once more?
Okay. I apologize if my connection is poor. I was going to say a couple slides back, there was,
we're on the performance slide.
Yes, the performance slide. So the historic real return of the fund, and I was wondering how that, the historic real return of the fund compares against Callan's projected return going forward that we should use for assumptive purposes, and how those two figures compare and contrast.
Right. Now I understand. Thank you for repeating the question. Through the chair, Representative Price Tompkins, if you look at Callan's projections, they're looking at, they're forecasting a 4.2% real return for the next 10 years. That is a 5% plus real. So the question is can we make up that 80 basis point of differential between those two? And I think as a corporation, the Board of Trustees, that is our intention, is to be able to make that and beat those forecasts. We do it through asset allocation. We do it through, for example, and I don't have it here, but if you looked at our returns on private equity versus the 8% that is being forecasted by Callan, you'll see that we routinely come in with double-digit returns on private equity. So there's a balance to all of this. It is going to be hard to make the 5% real return in a low growth, slow return environment. And there is concern about that. But having said that, we are not recommending any changes to the 5%. That is something that I think
it's
best, we're not recommending any changes to the 5%.
Okay. Thank you. So I did say, was going to give Representative Price Cummings the last question, but then I got a note, Representative Vance has a question, Representative Snyder has a question. So if you could each, Representative Vance, I'll let you go next because you haven't asked any yet. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Klayman. I just have one question for Ms. Rodell. And what would the trustees consider when evaluating whether a one-time unstructured draw can be taken without undermining the health of the growth of the fund?
I think through the chair, Representative Vance, I understand your question. The trustees are uniform and adamant in the recommendation that there be no unstructured draws on the fund, period, no matter what the size or what's the reason. And I think part of the concern is that we've had, is every year, if there's unstructured draws, then the QMB completely loses all of its effectiveness. And so we would encourage you not to go down the path of unstructured draws.
Representative Snyder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think my question is along that same line as Representative Vance. And so to put a finer point on it, the proposed $3 billion bridge draw, as it's being referred to in the resolution in front of us, that is directing our meeting today, that would be unadvisable. Could you, according to the corporation, could you specify what particular losses we would be looking at with a draw of that size?
Through the chair, I think that it's really important to recognize that our role in all of this is to manage the assets we have in front of it. You do, unfortunately, have to come up with a bigger plan and determine what are the best tools for that plan. And maybe part of it is to take an ad hoc draw. It has a cost to the fund. So if we're earning 25% this year, had you taken $3 billion out a year ago, you know, the 6%, you know, on that $3 billion you're looking at, those are the types of losses. I believe Ledge Finance has run various scenarios on this to give you a sense of the magnitude of those losses. And those are the decisions that are beyond the Permanent Fund Corporation or myself. And so I don't have anything to add on that point.
Thank you. Thank you very much for taking the time today to make a presentation to the committee. Next, we'll hear invited testimony from Curtis Thayer with the Alaska Energy Authority. Mr. Thayer, if you want to state your name for the record, you can proceed with your presentation, and after the presentation, we'll go to questions.
All right. Thank you very much. My name is Curtis Thayer, and I serve as the Executive Director of the Alaska Energy Authority. And a little bit about who we are on the next slide. We were created in 1976 by the Alaska State Legislature as the Alaska Energy Authority, and we are a public corporation governed by an independent board of directors with the mission to reduce the cost of energy in Alaska. And AEA is the state energy office and lead agency for statewide energy policy and program development. The next slide. Our issue today, or the reason today, is the power cost equalization program. The PCE program was established in 1985 as one of the components of a statewide energy plan to help equalize the high cost of electricity in rural communities with the lower cost in more urban areas. Next slide. You can see almost approximately 82,000 Alaskans, or just under 200 rural communities with their high cost of energy. The program seeks to reduce the high cost of electricity paid by rural consumers to a level comparable to the average rates paid in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau. And that's accomplished by looking at those three urban communities, and the established rate this year by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska is 20 cents. Therefore, PCE will subsidize rural power for consumers up to 550 kilowatts per household at that 20 cents. And in rural Alaska, some of these costs can be 30 cents all the way to over a dollar a kilowatt usage. This does not apply to commercial buildings or government buildings. This is just to rural residents and community facilities. And this helps ensures the financial viability for rural communities. And it helps reliable lower costs to enhance the quality of life, the standard of living, and economic strength of these communities. Next slide. In a map of Alaska, you see where approximately those 200 communities are. And as you'll notice, they're not on the rail belt. Fairbanks, all the way down to the peninsula, are not covered by PCE. It's primarily rural Alaska, from Metlakatla all the way up into to the northern part of Alaska and down on the Aleutian Islands. The PCE program in fiscal 2020, it was a benefit to 81,700 households, individuals, with 192 communities that were eligible for PCE credits. And last year, the amount dispersed was a little bit more than $26.6 million. that number will fluctuate depending on the price, the energy price among the three utilities. The PCE, next slide. The PCE has a PCE endowment fund. The PCE, our disbursements are funded by the PCE endowment. It was created in 2001 and is managed by the Department of Revenue. And the Alaska Statute 4245.05 provides a 5-year percent of the PCE endowment, 3-year average market value, may be appropriate to the program. And in doing so on slide 8, which is the next slide, it gives you a little bit of perspective of the PCE endowment over the 5-year look back. Currently, the fund stands at close to $1.1 billion. It's pretty consistent during the last 5 years. However, one thing, the earnings, the first year in Eric, like you're saying, the earnings, the fund was just growing and was just $8.9 million. And in FY17, it was $112 million, and then $76 million, $74. And this last year was $48 million, which is rather disappointing. But that's been the average earning. And then the outflows for it is the actual cost of PCE payments. And then the program administration by AEA, the administrative fee by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, that's to help oversee and establish what that rate structure will be in the communities. And then there's a management fee by the Department of Revenue, which, like I said, the ending balance of one little shy of $1.1 billion. So that's just a little bit of history on the PCE program and the endowment. I think it's really important to note that when people look at the PCE endowment, they do see $1.1 billion. But what's not seen is the amount of money the state of Alaska has actually invested in the urban infrastructure, which helps lower the rate of everybody on the railroad. AEA owns and operates the Bradley Lake Hydro Project, the largest hydro project in Alaska, providing 10% of the railroad energy needs. That was an investment of the state of well over $300 million. We have the inner side north of Fairbank, or north of Willow. It goes up to Healy next to the Golden Valley. That ownership, that inner tie by AEA, saves the Fairbanks consumers $40 million a year if they can buy fuel or they can buy their electric car lower and put the inlet and ship it up on the inner tie and provide it to their residents. And so when you look at $1.1 billion to Alaska in the PCE, again, you don't see the hundreds, if not well over $1 billion, that have invested in Cook Inlet and the rail belt. And so that's something that I think people need to think about when they look at both of those. And that does not even account for the hundreds of millions of dollars of tax credits for looking for natural gas or encouraging looking for natural gas and gas shortages about 10 years ago. But that's just a snapshot of the PCE endowment and how it's delivered and the benefits to rural Alaska. And I'm available for questions. I was told to keep it short.
So, Mr. Thayer, can you talk about the governor's proposal to put these funds into the permanent fund and manage it from the permanent fund, or is that something that Mr. Barnhill is going to address?
I think it's something Mr. Barnhill is going to address, but it is something that our board of directors has unanimously endorsed moving the PCE endowment into the corpus of the permanent fund. One of the things that happened about 2 years ago is when the legislature did not reverse the sweep and the money and the PCE endowment got swept into the Constitutional Budget Reserve, it really caused angst and concern in rural Alaska about those energy costs. And I know that's something that the legislature has looked and struggled with the last couple of years. And so by taking the endowment and putting it into a safe place, knowing that it's going to be used for what the intention was, and that is the PCE program, I think that goes to alleviate a lot of those concerns and goes back to the reason that the funding of the PCE program was for it to be part of an energy plan and help those higher costs of Alaska.
So, okay. Let me, there's a number of folks with questions that I've now got four folks with questions in the queue. My query is, and I'll just leave it open, you can say if you have a question specifically about how the PCE has been managed in the past, then let's get those questions out. If you have questions about the proposal to move the PCE into the permanent fund, we should hold on those until after, until Mr. Barnhill has provided his additional testimony about the governor's proposal to move the PCE into the permanent fund. And I'm not sure who, but I'll start. Representative Drummond, you actually haven't asked a question all day. Do you have a question about the PCE generally, or do you have a question about the constitutional proposal? Representative Drummond, take yourself off mute, please.
I did. Can you hear me now?
Yes, loud and clear.
Okay, great. Thank you for the presentation, Mr. Thayer. I understand that nearly 82,000 Alaskans benefit from PCE credits. I am assuming that that is through residential energy costs. What about the cost of energy for institutions in the same community, such as schools? Do those institutions benefit from a reduction in energy costs, or are they paying the full cost?
Mr. Thayer.
I heard that through residential energy costs, and then it was garbled after that.
The question, and if I get it wrong, Representative Drummond can correct me. The question was, community organizations or community groups like schools, do they also benefit from the power cost equalization, or is it strictly residential customers?
Through the chair, it is strictly residential customers and community buildings. Schools are not necessarily considered community buildings. They're government buildings, and therefore they have their own budgets to pay for the energy costs. So it is strictly a residential program.
Any follow-up, Representative Drummond, on that?
I would love to figure out a way for what's happening in schools is that their energy costs are so high they're having to lay off staff in order to pay their energy bills, and somehow that doesn't make sense. What would it take to extend the benefits of the PCE to organizations such as schools that have to function in the same high-cost environment as the residential energy users that are currently benefiting from the PCE?
Through the chair, it would probably take a statutory change because it's set by statute as far as it being a residential program and would possibly double, if not triple, the cost of the cost of Alaska of the PCE program.
Okay, thank you.
Next, Representative Kirka, is your question about past PCE issues, or is your question about the proposal to put it into the permanent fund?
My question about the proposal and effects on other options.
So if you don't mind, we'll hold until after we hear from Mr. Barnhill on your question, but I'll keep you in my list of cues. Representative Eastman, you have a question about past PCE or rather than the proposal?
Yeah, my question is general to the past PCE.
Please proceed.
I'm curious to know, you mentioned, I think, 191 communities being serviced by the PCE currently. I might have that number a little bit wrong, but I took down in my notes. And I'm just wondering, is there a list of those committees available to the public or to the committee? And then also within those committees, what percentage of the people residing in those committees are actually receiving the subsidy?
Through the chair, yes, that's public information, and we do forward and send to all the legislators and resend our statistical report that lists by community who's receiving PCE, the size of the community, their average cost of PCE, not only in the current year but previous years. And so we have that information, and I'll be more than happy to provide it to your office.
Great. Thank you.
Representative Snyder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple clarifying questions and to understand some historical context. In prepping for this meeting, I was able to take a peek at the AEA's Power Cost Equalization Program Guide updated in 2019 and noticed that at the time of publication, it was 7% of the 3-year monthly average market value that was that could be appropriated. And I just want to understand, was that then updated in statute since? Because I believe it's 5% in statute now.
Through the chair, by what I have, that would be the management of it, is I have a 3-year market value maybe appropriate program that says 5% of PC endowment.
Okay.
Under statute 42.45.085.
Okay.
And that would be a question for the Department of Revenue as they manage the fund.
Okay, thank you. And it may just be a matter of timing of statute update with this report being done in 2019. We can follow up. May I have one more follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Representative Snyder.
Thank you. And Mr. Thayer, forgive me if you addressed this and I missed it when you were on slide 8. Could you speak a little bit more to the 2019 and 2020 transfers and appropriations to other funds? Remind me what that was to.
In FY 2019, currently under statute, the first PCE is paid first, and then community assistance up to $30 million is provided. And then if there's additional revenue from that, then it would be going to 3 buckets, as you might call it, into the Renewable Energy Fund or into the Revolving Loan Fund on bulk fuel, or it would go into the powerhouse upgrades. And in that particular year, when you look back at FY 2017, 3 years later, that funding was available. Therefore, $30 million worth of community assistance through OLAPS was provided and about $14 billion, again, between the Renewable Energy Fund, powerhouse, primarily into improving powerhouses in Alaska, and the bulk fuel revolving loan fund did not need any funding, and they did not take any funding that year. What you see in FY 20, though, that $14 million, that was money that was allocated by the legislature for non-rural investment. I believe $7 or $8 million of that went to the Department of Corrections, and it was dispersed out to different state departments by the legislature, and therefore they did not go into rural Alaska or back into community assistance or anything of that nature.
Thank you.
And I can get you a breakdown of the FY 2020 spend.
Thank you. Much appreciated.
Do you want that breakdown?
I would appreciate that breakdown, yes. Thank you.
Okay. I don't see any other questions with regard to what I call the past history and actually the current practices for power cost equalization. So next. Is that Representative Vance?
Yes, I have a question.
Oh, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question regarding just more of the history of the fund and what the plans are of AEA going into the future. Currently, the PCE has been used to provide a subsidy, but can you speak to what the original plan was with the endowment for energy solutions and what the plans are for AEA to provide those energy solutions in the future? Do you have any ideas moving forward that goes beyond just the subsidy?
That's my... I was probably the person moving a couple of papers, and I apologized. That's okay. I need that reminder. That doesn't mean we all get it. Representative Vance, I think, Representative Vance, why don't you try the question again briefly, because I think you'll state it better than me.
Thank you. The question is regarding the original purpose of the endowment to provide energy solutions, and can you speak to that briefly, and also what AEA's plans are to provide energy solutions beyond a subsidy in the future?
Through the chair, if I understand the question correctly, the endowment was originally established to help lower the cost of power in rural Alaska through the PCE program. and that was to keep those costs low. AEA as a whole, through the Renewable Energy Fund and with additional funding for powerhouses and bulk fuel, we continue to look for ways to lower the cost of power into rural Alaska with renewables. But one issue that we have in rural Alaska is these communities are sometimes very far apart. They're not connected by a grid, and they don't necessarily have the ability where we can get people on hydro in Southeast. We do. We have biomass programs. We have solar, and we have wind. But the backbone of rural Alaska continues to be diesel. And we place powerhouses to get the most efficient diesel generation that we can. But the PC program is always established to help lower that cost because, again, the endowment was the earnings was to help rural Alaska offset their higher cost of energy, where the state of Alaska's policy has to spend billions of dollars on infrastructure in urban Alaska that they have not been able to fund in rural Alaska.
All right, I think that now brings us to Mr. Barnhill. Mr. Barnhill, if you want to give us some details with regard to the governor's proposal to move the power cost equalization funds into the permanent fund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Mike Barnhill, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue. And so, again, Mr. Chair, the administration appreciates the latitude that you provided the administration to discuss a measure that's not actually before the committee. So for the record, I'll be referring to the vehicle that's in the Senate, which is Committee Substitute for SJR 6 Judiciary. And specifically what that measure proposes with respect to power cost equalization is that the balance of the power cost equalization endowment fund on June 30th, 2023, would be transferred to the principal of the permanent fund. And it would be commingled with the assets of the permanent fund. There would be no separate account. And then SJR 6 proposes a constitutional dedication of revenue from the permanent fund to the purposes of power cost equalization in the state. And the specific section in the bill is set out on page 2, lines 10 to 14, and it just provides, each year the legislature shall appropriate a portion of the amounts appropriated under B of this section, and that's referring to the percent market value appropriation, for power cost equalization. The amount appropriated shall be the amount necessary to equalize the cost of power in the state according to state law, but may not exceed 50% of the amount appropriated under the of the section. And so it's a mandatory revenue dedication to power cost equalization, the details to be provided by the state legislature through statute. So that's it in a nutshell. And there are a number of questions pending for me, and I'm happy to take those up now or as the chair desires.
I know the first person that I question is Representative Kirker, so I'll let him have the first run at it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Working on a poll here. Hopefully you can hear me okay. So I guess I have a couple of questions. One question was, I know there's been some rural representatives who have been talking about using some of or all of their chunk of the PCE funds for the purpose of infrastructure projects in the bush to lower the cost of energy where it would make sense, or basically scale back the program by reducing the number of people in the program because you have lower energy in certain areas. It would seem to me that this proposal would preclude that from ever being an option by locking up the fund in the Constitution. That's my first question. I guess I'll wait for it.
Yeah.
Through the Chair, Representative Burka, Details on how this gets implemented would be specified by the legislature and statute. But at first blush, the proposal, the scenario, for example, the fugitive doesn't sound to me like it would offend the language in the Constitution as proposed.
And I know you've got a follow-up, so go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, so, Mr. Barnhill, you mentioned a minute ago that the PCE fund would be mingled with the permanent fund, that they would, you know, the investments would be together, wouldn't be separate accounts. I guess I'm trying to think down the road about the, I guess, the long-term consequences of that in terms of if the return on that portion of the fund would be contributory towards future dividends, and the return on the overall fund would, I guess, be contributory towards the PCE endowment. I guess I'm also wondering, I guess I need to look at the details of how this works. What is preventing the endowment from pulling from the broader fund at large? The selling is now all in one.
Through the chair, Representative Kirkman, so when I said that the Power Cost Equalization Endowment Fund balance would be deposited and commingled with the permanent fund balance, to be quite explicit, there would be no separate balance tracked from that point forward. It would simply be the permanent fund. There would be no separate balance tracked for the Power Cost Equalization Fund. But in exchange, there's a very important change that's proposed for the Constitution, and that is a revenue dedication. Right now the only revenue dedication we have in the Constitution is that 25% of royalties that are dedicated to the principal of the permanent fund. This would be a new revenue dedication in which the legislature would specify the details, but the revenue would be dedicated from the permanent fund for the purpose of power cost equalization in the state as defined by the legislature. So we wouldn't be tracking separate balances for power cost equalization. There wouldn't be any separate returns associated with power cost equalization. There would just be one account, the permanent fund account, one set of returns.
Representative Kirkham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The chair, it would seem to me then that in essence, wouldn't that make the PCE program, appropriation of that fund, wouldn't that essentially be an unstructured draw? Because we don't know what the dollar amount would be if just they could grow and could trade to them. It's not just what a percentage that would be.
Through the chair, Representative Kirk, I'm glad you asked that question. Because the revenue dedication happens within the context of the percent of market value distribution. In other words, it's a portion of that. It's not outside of it. So it's entirely within the structured draw that's established in SJR 6, which is the 5% of the average of the permanent fund.
Okay, and then, Mr. Chairman, I have a separate question.
Representative Kerger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Barnhill, I may have asked this question on a separate call. That'd be a good one to ask on the record. Or concern, I didn't ask the question, on the question. So I noticed that we look at the Constitution. The rights, the benefits, the privileges throughout the Constitution are all Alaskans. And I recognize the original purpose of the PCE endowment in the fund as being a balance to the government investment, so to speak, in the infrastructure and the rail belt for the local communities. That balance being for the communities. But it would seem to me that this would be a dramatic change in the nature of the Constitution, because now we are enshrining a subsidy program that is selective. We're just writing in the Constitution that is selective for certain regions of the state or select Alaskans, not all Alaskans. And I'm concerned about, I guess going down that road of
segregating people and treating them differently, so to speak. And having that major departure from the current principles we see in the custom.
Mr. Barnhill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Kirka. It is a policy that the governor is suggesting that the legislature consider, and then if the legislature supports it by a supermajority, it would be placed before the people for consideration in amending the Constitution. Ultimately, the Constitution reflects the will of the people, and if the will of the people decide that it's to achieve equality or equalization and power costs throughout the state, that's a completely fair topic to take up in the Constitution.
Next, I have Representative Eastman with a question.
Currently, we have the PCE address in statute without any reference to it in the Constitution. If SDR 6 passes and our Constitution now includes this dedicated appropriation, does that create an entitlement to the Constitution?
Through the Chair, Representative Eastman, my preference is to use the phrase dedication because that's exactly what it creates. I'll leave it to others to decide whether it also falls under the characterization as an entitlement. But as a constitutional dedication of revenues to a purpose, it has the force of constitutional law, presumably to be enforced by the courts. The language as drafted says shall appropriate, so it cannot be circumvented by the legislature. That's how it works.
And Paul?
Representative Eastman.
And so I'm trying to anticipate if the intention of the governor through SDR 6 to create an expectation of a subsidy and then trying, I think it appears to me that it is creating that expectation. And when the legislature goes to either maintain or update the statutes that, instantiate exactly how that's going to work, what's the person coming in and saying that the expectation is bigger in the future than we do have currently under statute? For example, right now, the language in SDR 6 is very broad. It's basically saying that the law is going to explain how you balance the cost of energy throughout the state. There are only 191 communities that are currently recipients of that program, but I can certainly see someone going to court and saying, I'm not one of those 191, I'm 192 or 3 or 4, but my costs are higher than the community next door, and I want to be part of this program. How do you anticipate that going based on your intent, based on the governor's intent?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, we're starting to shade into legal areas that may be more preferential to have the Department of Law speak to. But I would say this is a general matter. Access the courts to complain about how the Constitution or statutes get interpreted is just a part of our system. And there's nothing to prevent people from accessing the courts so they can have their say in court as to what they think the interpretation of a statute or a constitutional provision should be. In this particular case, I think a court would draw from the fact that power cost equalization has been in statute for some decades. They would probably draw from the statutory history in terms of how they would interpret the constitutional provision to the extent that it appears that the people sought to essentially constitutionalize a particular program.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. Well, it would occur to me if her intent, that intent, was simply to copy over into the Constitution what we have currently, then I would expect that we would not have this broad language. Broad language is really what I'm getting at. Maybe we can talk to the Department of Law about that. Question for you right now is, what happens to the community assistance program? Does that go away under this new constitutional scheme?
To the chair, Representative Eastman. So the community assistance program is not part of this constitutional resolution. It's a separate program. Currently, it sometimes gets funded by hospitalization. And how that program gets funded in the future will remain prerogative of the legislature's appropriation power. It's the administration's expectation that the community assistance program will continue in the current form and will continue to be funded, but from another funding source.
Thank you.
Thank you. Last, Representative Snyder. I don't want to take, hopefully we can move along and get to Mr. Halford before the day gets too late.
Mr. Chair. Hi, Mr. Barnhill. I'm trying to wrap my brain around, and I'm wondering if you all have thought about this and done some initial calculations, assuming if this were to move forward and be adopted, and assuming we maintain the same same approach to calculating the PCE level, would there be a difference between the amount? Let me try this again. So if we were to adopt this approach and we do the percent of market value draw, and then it's a 50-50 split between the dividend and the government, and we now, but according to this approach, we would first need to satisfy the PCE payment, would that result in a lower amount of money being available for government services if it's combined than if they were to stay separate and the PCE was not placed in the Constitution and it kept its own fund?
The amount that would be available for our hospitalization is essentially what the legislature would decide through statute and appropriation. The Constitution requires amount sufficient to equalize power, not necessarily to equalize power. The legislature decides what that amount is. It could be greater or less than the amount today. And it's committed to legislative discretion. The funding available to provide, the balance of funding available to provide funding for power cost equalization is the same before and after. In other words, there's money in the permanent fund that distributes percent of market value. To that would be added the balance of the power cost equalization fund, which is $1 billion. It's just in a different place, and it's up to the legislature to decide how, if the legislature wishes to do it formulaically like it does now, it would be up to the legislature to implement that through statute.
I can save time.
Follow.
Okay.
Follow.
I think the crux of my question was, if we maintain the same calculations that we utilize now, if that were not to change, but now we find ourselves in a situation where we're drawing from the same funds, we're doing a 50-50 split, and now we're funding government and PCE both from that 50-50 split. Have the calculations been done to compare if there is any difference, however small, the distribution would be if PCE maintained its own funds?
Through the chair, Representative Snyder, if I'm following you correctly, in order to do that, you would have to maintain some internal separate balance for the power cost equalization fund once it's shifted into the permanent fund. Because right now, the way the statute is read, it's the the PCE endowment fund is a endowment fund that has a POMB structure like you're proposing for the permanent fund in the Constitution, and that is it's 5% of the three-year mark value average of the fund. In order to maintain that formula, you would have to maintain some internal balance of the PCE fund once it's deposited into the permanent fund. Alternatively, you can come up with a formulaic approach that's applied to the percent of market value distribution every year that is intended to equate to what we're currently getting from the statutory fund. I mean, there are mathematical ways of achieving a similar number before and after the deposit.
Thank you.
Thank you. The question I have is, we heard earlier from Ms. Rodell from the Permanent Fund Corporation how the Mental Health Trust and the Mental Health Trust is managed, or those funds are managed by the Permanent Fund Corporation, but they essentially keep them, they're mixed, but they're also segregated. I mean, they know how much is allocated towards the Mental Health Trust. Why not use a similar proposal? Or are you proposing a similar proposal for the PC? It doesn't sound like it, but why not use a similar structure in which the permanent fund manages the money, but in the same way as the Mental Health Trust has a certain percentage allocation of the total value of the permanent fund, and then that is managed by the PCE kind of like its own. But the big dollars are managed by the fund, but it's still kept separate from the rest of the permanent fund monies, and for that matter, the Mental Health Trust monies. Why not use that approach?
As to the reasons why the proposal does not do that, I don't speculate. There are perhaps reasons that you could spend either more or less than today. So by not continuing the statutory formula in its current form, it does provide greater legislative flexibility with respect to appropriation for power. And I would hasten to add that flexibility is governed by the shall language in this measure. Shall appropriate, shall be the amount necessary to equalize. So that could result in a greater amount of money. It could result in a smaller amount of money available for power cost equalization, but it would have to comply with the amount, the shall be the amount necessary.
And so a slightly different question. If the legislature wanted to essentially treat the power cost equalization funds like mental health trust funds and create, like the mental health trust, let permanent fund manage those funds, but also keep them kind of on their own in the same way the mental health trust funds are on its own, do we need a constitutional change to do that, or could we do that by statute today?
Mr. Chair, you can do that by statute today. One of the sort of the benefits of the way the permanent fund does now is it's not maintaining separate asset allocation for the three accounts that Director Rodell spoke to, the principal account.
We'd essentially be creating a fourth account.
But as you add more accounts to the permanent fund, you do run into a potential issue where they may need different asset allocations because they have different different risk preferences, different investment horizons. And so things do start to get complicated as you add more. But to the extent that the decision was made that the risk preferences, the risk tolerances and investment horizons, the permanent fund, mental health trust, and the power cost equalization are the same, and you could commingle it as they did today.
Thank you. I don't see other questions. Thank you very much for that presentation. And our last person we're hearing from today is former Senator Rick Halford. Senator Halford, I apologize that we are running a little late, but I will let folks on the committee know I'm more than happy to run
run late today. I know it's a beautiful sunny afternoon, at least here in Anchorage, so I'm thinking let's give this at least till 3:15 to give Mr. Halford at least 30 minutes of presentation. Mr. Halford, if you want to state your name for the record, you can go forward with your remarks. I would note that I had sent some topics that I was interested in having Mr. Halford present on, but I'll let him just proceed as he wishes. Mr. Halford.
Mr. Chairman, this is Rick Halford. I'm calling from Allegheny in Bristol Bay, and I would like you to kind of go through the questions as you see the interest, both yours and the committee's, but I'd give you just a little bit of starting point in terms of my own history. I came to Alaska in the mid-60s as a college student and never left, graduated from AMU in 1968. And I went into the air taxi business, the Air National Guard, became an owner-operator in the air taxi business and a guide. But I was originally elected to the House in 78. I was a House Majority Leader when the final dividend passed in 81. I was elected to the Senate in 2002. I was elected to the Senate in 82. And was Senate Minority Leader for one term, Majority Leader for four or five terms, and Senate President a couple of times, and Finance Co-Chairman a couple of times. But amazing changes. I started out with a half a secretary in the other legislator's office, and our greatest technology that we really wanted to get was an IBM Selectric typewriter. And, some of the people that advocate for the history of the permanent fund somehow think we're smarter than you are, and that's just the opposite. You have 40 years of information and history, and you carry the Library of Congress in your pocket, in your phone. It's amazing what's happened, and I am very grateful that we're able to pass on to you some of the largesse that we enjoyed. A very important asset. I think we looked at it in terms of where we started when the oil income case started to come in. We had a fairly aggressive state income tax, and we were way behind on an awful lot of things. But we were getting the income tax and about a third of the value of the oil. Today we're in a very different situation, but we had some incredible people that were kind of working both in the legislature and out of the legislature. We give Jay Hammond a lot of credit for the permanent fund, and he certainly deserves it in the political push. But Elmer Rasmussen was a huge factor in how it was actually organized and how it actually worked. Malone, Gardner, Greening, we tend to argue about what it was for, and Elmer actually went around the state trying to get people to decide what it was for, and they never got agreement, and it's written in the permanent fund papers that the only agreement was to have a savings account. And like when we start a savings account, it's not necessarily an account for a new truck or a retirement account or a big project account or a loan fund program or a dividend account. It's just a savings account. And people have added a lot of intent that really wasn't there. There were differences in intent, and they were the full spectrum. Initially, the people who opposed the creation of the permanent fund were very quick to come and say, well, we meant it was a loan fund, or we meant it was a subsidy to the government or a dividend fund or whatever it was. But there was no agreement on what it was for. I'd defer to you, Mr. Chairman, to kind of go through the questions that you have that there's interest in, rather than going through a long litany of things that you're not interested in.
Sure. The next area that I'd suggest is talk a little bit about the history of dividend formulas, because I know the original formula for dividends after the permanent fund amendment passed, the legislature put in a formula that was later challenged by Ron and Penny Zobel that led to that formula being struck down. But tell us a little bit more about the the original formula and what changes the legislature made, both while the Zobel lawsuit was pending and before the decision, and then what happened after that decision?
Well, the original formula was it basically took the time since statehood and gave you a share for every year, and it was a differential residency formula that was struck down in the Supreme Court. That took several years to actually happen, but I believe it was in 1981 we passed what Hammond considered the backup formula, which was equal dividends to everyone. It's important that, you know, in key issues of how that actually happened, there were pieces of that that were pretty contentious. The whole inclusion of minors, the welfare hold harmless, inflation proofing had always been contentious. But if you go back to, again, the starting point of it all, how big was the dividend to who? And you look at the repeal of the state income tax, probably represented a $100,000 a year dividend to the top 1,000 taxpayers in the state of Alaska. And the first dividend was $1,000, but it was intended to be kind of 3 years catching up while we were in court and all this other stuff. So then the dividend went down to $300 or $400. But today that dividend would be somewhere over $3,000 if you just let inflation go forward. But it wasn't easy to make the decisions with regard to minors, with regard to the whole harmless, and you had to look at it in the context of everything else going on. We were spending huge amounts of money in housing subsidies that were worth, in some cases, $15,000 or $20,000 a year to people that could afford to build very, very expensive houses. The income tax repeal had a huge differential effect in terms of how your income was. So that's kind of the background of how we got to the dividend. And the system really worked. It was an example for the World Bank that they counted. It was probably the best analysis of history to those who might want to really look for it is Dave Rose's book, Saving for the Future, because that is an analysis of the 20 plus years that he was involved, and it wasn't always complimentary to any of us, but it was a very, very important resource for understanding how we got where we got.
So in the after the passage of the first permanent fund, or the permanent fund constitutional amendment, my understanding is there were some efforts to try to pass some other constitutional amendments in the early 80s, perhaps, to provide more structure in the Constitution for the permanent fund. What can you tell us about those efforts? What passed, what didn't pass?
And well, what Dave Rose really points out, you know, the whole thing of what do we do with the permanent fund, because that was the unanswered question. Was it to be dividends forever? But, you know, the analysis, when we got into the late 80s and we had a serious bump in the price of oil, still lots of quantity of oil, but a serious bump in the price of oil and the state's income, Jay Hammond was still alive, and the Senate actually put together a package which we sent to the House. The package included a constitutional spending limit update and the creation of the Constitutional Budget Reserve and a permanent fund allocation amendment, which we called 40-30-30, that Hammond actually supported. And what it did is it said 40% of the income goes to dividends, and that matched about what the actual amount going to dividends was at that time, because the balance was going up rapidly and it was based on a five-year average. The actual payout from the last year was closer to 40% than 50%. But that passed the Senate, went to the House. The House passed the Constitutional Budget Reserve with a floor amendment that increased the two-thirds majority required to a three-fourths majority, and didn't pass either the spending limit or the constitutional amendment with regard to the permanent fund. So it's been in continuous debate. I mean, at the time Sheffield was elected right after Hammond, the first place that he wanted to go to get money for shortages was the permanent fund system. He quickly realized that that was very unpopular and didn't do it, but it went on. Steve Cooper offered an education endowment to sideline some of the permanent fund's income. If that had happened, the permanent fund would be worth about half of what it is today. Hickel said that he would go to the ballot in before he did anything, and he kept that commitment to Hammond. But Tony Knowles did as well, and of course it went to the ballot. But probably the one time that we actually sent something from the Senate to the House was that 40-30-30 proposal. And that's in the record. You can get a copy of that. And it was what we came up with at that time. And again, you have so much more information and so much more access than we did. But it is certainly a possibility.
If 40% was the dividends on the 40-30-30, what were the 30% 30% for?
Well, we maintained the realized income formula. So what the other, it was 30% for inflation proofing, 30% to government appropriations, and 40% to dividends. One of the things that happened in that time frame is the revenue crisis abated and the need for it slowed down. That's part of why the House didn't deal with the Senate proposal.
What's your perspective on the role of the dividend in our structure of government here in Alaska today?
Well, it's a huge benefit from the bottom. I mean, again, we have become very, very fortunate with all the oil value. And if we are the owner state, then the shares of that ownership should be equal. You know, one of the things that's not pointed out enough is there is not any significant tax money in any of the permanent fund system. It's ownership money. And if we're an owner state and owner individuals, then the ownership should be just as important to somebody who holds a sign standing by Northern Lights Boulevard as somebody else. It's not tax money, and it never has been in any significant amount, and it's not taking from one person to give to another person. It's sharing the common property resources of an owner state. And one of Hammond's goals in that whole process was to let people recognize that what happens to our resources is, and we're very fortunate to have this, we are a trust state. And that trust is to all generations, and when you're dealing with non-renewable resources, you should make a serious effort to look out for not just yourself, but your grandchildren and your great-grandchildren and their great-grandchildren.
How do we balance the interest in protecting the principal of the fund with the interest in paying a dividend, for example, following the current formula and statute, and then protecting the principal shown in the POMV law? What's your thought on how we balance those competing interests?
Well, first of all, nothing is easy. If you don't do anything, and it just goes down the road, eventually the statutory permanent POMV will become unconstitutional when the reserve is gone, because you can't reduce the value of the principal. So that's what's at stake in this equation, and I very much think and a lot of you are realizing that the solution has to be a constitutional solution. That brings the people into some kind of a final decision. I would hope that, you know, again, number one, the permanent fund has to be permanent. That means whatever percentage you use, whatever mechanism you use, it can never reduce the real value of the fund. I believe that it has to be somehow connected to the people. When we used to watch the television and some elementary school student would announce the amount of the permanent fund dividend, people didn't argue if it went down. They recognized it was following the market, and they felt empowered and included in the whole process. That was very important to to the understanding and the defense of the permanent fund. And I think finally, it needs to be something that deals with an equitable share. Again, you know, power, position, age, longevity, all these things help the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. And we tried to short circuit that as much as we could with the permanent fund dividend and the hold harmless and minors provisions, and it worked. If you look at the data, the state of Alaska's difference between rich and poor didn't grow as astronomically as it did in the rest of the country. And that was a great success of the system. It was part of why the World Bank looked at it and said, this is how to give your residents some kind of a stake in what's happening with what they should be collective owners of. And I think it was a very good thing. But again, no decline, connected to the people, and equitable shares are the most important elements of whatever you come up with.
All right, I think that probably puts us in a good place to take questions from members of the committee. Members of the committee with questions for Senator Halford. Representative Snyder.
Hello, good afternoon. Through the chair, I heard you acknowledge the utility and importance of protecting the permanent fund in the Constitution and putting it before the people as a way to finalize this ongoing conversation. Does that also include specifying within the Constitution how it would be divided between the dividend and government services?
Well, I'm certainly on record supporting the old system. The governor has come out with a 50-50 and a 5%. I am concerned about the 5%. The 50-50 sounds good, although I would probably say it in a different way. I would say no more may be appropriated for government than is appropriated to individuals through the an equal dividend, just because I think that gives you a defense against some kind of an entitlement argument or something else. But, I mean, you know, you have to, it's your turn to try and figure that out. I did everything I could to support additional deposits, to defend the fund, and work toward giving you as big a choice as we had. We are collectively, and I mean this toward the legislature, but in a bigger way toward the population of the state of Alaska, we are incredibly spoiled. We have had a complete generation of shopping in the stores and restaurants of everything without prices on the menu because the cost was going somewhere else. Now we have to recognize that we should probably pay for part of it. We should look at whether we're getting a fair share for our resources. And we're going to have to look in part to our savings. But if you ask people, it's interesting. Everyone has, you know, if they have interest in maintaining the size of state government, that's their first priority. But they will say the dividend should be the last thing taken. But they also will hedge that if they see it affecting their piece. If they're in the resource extraction business, they believe that the dividend has to go if that's necessary to maintain their benefit. If they're in the really high income brackets, they believe that the dividend is somehow their tax money going somewhere else. It isn't, and that's a mistake. But we have to face all those issues, but we never will until the permanent fund, number one, dividend, and the fund itself are off the table. And I believe that there are ways that people can go backwards over time with court participation and destroy the entire system. And I just I think that's a crime against our grandchildren.
I don't see hands up, but I'll actually, because we're after 3 o'clock, I'm going to go ahead and ask folks if they have questions and start with Representative Kreis Tompkins. Any questions for Senator Halford?
None here, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Representative Drummond, any questions for Senator Halford?
No, thank you, Chairman. I just really appreciate hearing the Senator's perspective. It's a good grounding in how we need to be doing things. Thank you.
Representative Eastman, any questions for the Senator? Thank you very much, Representative Vance. I want to thank you again for suggesting that we invite Senator Alford. Any questions for the Senator?
Not at this time. He answered a lot of the questions already. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And Representative Kirk, any questions for the Senator?
Not at this time, Mr. Chairman.
And Senator Helfer, I actually had one question. I was not familiar with the proposal back for the 40-30-30 plan. Do you have any idea? Well, you can't speak for the government, but do you think there's merit if we're going to try to do any kind of a divvying up amongst the draw to include inflation proofing in that calculation?
I think you have to include inflation proofing, particularly if you use a realized income formula. You can also use inflation proofing if you went back to something like 4%, or you put a provision in that said every X years the inflation rate shall be adjusted to whatever the real inflation rate is. But the term permanent that went before the voters, with substantial objection, by the way, from some, but the term permanent means just what it says. And it's a lie to tell people they have a permanent fund if inflation eats it. And that's what will happen if you get up in the 5% category. It probably won't happen if you're in the 4% category, and actually you'd see some gain. You know, we're still going to have to be educating kids in groups of 20, 30, or 40 on the Kobuk River when all the oil's gone. And everything we can pass forward, we should be doing it. We're still the most fortunate people under the American flag. We have the most, and we pay the least.
Thank you very much. That was the only area I had questions about. I don't think anybody else from the committee has questions. So, again, I really want to thank you for taking the time today and waiting for the first two testifiers to finish and running a little late. At this time, we will continue to hold the joint resolution. For further review, we will adjourn for the day. The time is now 3:06 p.m. Before I adjourn, I will note my current plan is to have another hearing on this bill next Wednesday at 3 o'clock, and we'll be getting notice out to the committee and getting that published either later today or else on Monday. But that's the current plan, is to have our next meeting at 3 o'clock on next Wednesday. And with that, we will adjourn for the day. The time is now 3:07 p.m.
Thank you all for your service.